It's the Rise and Shout Podcast, episode 110. I'm your host, Adam Mangum. First up is Greg Rebell of KSL. We talk about the BYU basketball team and the roster, and we also talk about Bronco Mendenhall getting on Twitter. Matt then comes on board. We talk about the BYU football team for 2013, Riley Nelson's recent K-Fan interview, and also our favorite Marvel superhero movies. Again, this is the Rise and Shout Podcast. Catch us at VanquishTheFoe.com. Follow us on Twitter at BYU_RiseShout. And of course, listen to a very long podcast right now. Welcoming back to the Rise and Shout Podcast. It's been too long, but of course we don't do as many of these in the offseason, Greg. But we're welcoming back Greg Rebell, the voice of the Cougars on KSL.
Always a pleasure, Adam. Good to be with you again.
Yes, we're happy, and we have, you know, the offseason seems slow, but then there's always something that comes up that you can talk about. And quite frankly, probably everyone that listens to this podcast, you and I could talk BYU sports whether the season's on or not. But one of the things that came up, Greg, that you had a piece on KSL.com that I thought was great. We had heard that about a week ago, that prep school star Frank Bartley had signed with BYU. He doesn't, that I saw in your story, nor have I seen anywhere else, had a direct connection to BYU. And I loved your story about his choice and why he decided to come. So can you walk us through a little bit, for those that maybe didn't read your story, why it is he chose to come to BYU over some other schools that it offers from, including some that were maybe closer to home or also maybe a little bit more familiar, like an Auburn?
Yeah, he really was ticketed for Auburn until pretty late in the game. And it's interesting, you know, you talk about what's the connection to BYU, and there isn't one. The connection came about in kind of a roundabout way, in that BYU was, you know, pretty well acquainted with Future College Prep, the school in Carson, California, and they'd made multiple trips there in season and after the season recruiting, but they were most interested in a point guard out of Keller, Texas, named Warren Sledge. Warren Sledge plays for Future College Prep, and that's who BYU, I think, was initially into. And while they were recruiting one guy, as so often happens, they liked somebody else. And so that's how they came, you know, to become acquainted with Frank Bartley. And by the way, Sledge ended up signing with the Citadel, so he's a D1 talent. They began to, you know, work with Frank Bartley, and it's just a situation where there was a real comfort level between coaching staff, family, player, campus, facility. I'm told that when Frank was on a tour of the athletics facility, Legacy Hall, that whole complex there on the BYU campus, that he was just taken with, you know, every element of that production. And the displays in Legacy Hall, you know, really are impressive, and not just, you know, from the awards standpoint, but when you get into the football offices and the kind of things they've got going on, the whole package of what BYU was presenting, let alone what you could show Frank at the Marriott Center with the new locker rooms and facilities there, everything that BYU showed him, he was really impressed with. And beyond just the actual, you know, this all looks pretty good, was the way he and his family felt about being in Provo. And it sounded very similar, Adam, to what Chase Fisher and his family felt.
Yeah.
Only the week before. Here's another non-LDS kid with limited connection to BYU. The only tie was Mark Pope. Talking about Chase Fisher now, the only tie was Mark Pope, who kind of helped get him to Wake Forest, but wasn't the lead recruiter to Wake. And then by the time Chase got to Wake, Coach Pope was already gone. So it was only kind of a peripheral connection there. So two non-LDS kids from, you know, the eastern part of the country end up finding their way to BYU, and what we find in both cases was just a real sense that there was comfort, there was a feel of family, and both parents and student athletes felt this, you know, this could be a really good place for me. And back to Frank Bartley, as his mom put it, you know, things like the honor code are nothing more than what Frank's been living his whole life, that he and his family believe in. I mean, you know, like you said, these are human values we're talking about. This is not anything, you know, too off the wall. This is kind of how we all hope to live. And so, you know, really fortuitous, because these are two guys that would have been under, if not off, the BYU radar for anybody following the program, who now appear to be, you know, poised to take on pretty significant roles with BYU for either, you know, 2 or 4 years to come. Whenever they get playing, of course, Chase can't play till next season, but he'll have 2 years after that. So, yeah, these are really interesting additions, a little off the beaten path in terms of, you know, recent recruiting patterns, but I'm excited to see how it all turns out.
So you think, and I think you may have mentioned this in your piece as well, but I certainly saw a few fans tweet about this. Is there an influence of Jimmer expanding the brand across the country and making BYU just seem like a more desirable basketball destination, kind of a lag effect of some of these, in Frank's case, where he was a quote-unquote kid watching Jimmer do what he did? Or is this, you know, BYU, this isn't exactly the first time a couple of non-LDS kids have played BYU basketball. Is there some of that Jimmer effect in this, or do you think these would have probably happened regardless?
Oh, I think it's parenthetical. I don't think it's, you know, the primary motivation, but both guys mentioned their affinity for and ability to see Jimmer play during that run that really stuck with them. Now, in Chase Fisher's case, it's kind of, you know, he feels like he can be that kind of guy. Frank Bartley's a different kind of player, but his, let's say, relationship with BYU, or rather awareness of BYU, is probably more linked to Jimmer than anything else. If you're talking about what he, you know, knew about the program, his mom told me that, you know, as a family, they were more acquainted with BYU as a football school.
Sure.
And so, you know, Jimmer becomes kind of the tie, you know, to Frank from a basketball standpoint, whereas Chase Fisher, and it's interesting to note that, you know, when Jimmer was playing, BYU didn't have the ESPN deal yet. So this is even pre-ESPN, and he was still, you know, a name and still being found, even though the games weren't as readily available. Certainly, you know, SportsCenter kind of adopted him that year, and regardless of whether or not they carried BYU's game, they certainly, you know, carried a lot of Jimmer and stuck with both Chase and Frank. But I think in Chase's case, you're seeing somebody that he actually, you know, if not modeled his game after, saw a similar type of skill set that he hopes could work in Provo as well. But I think you can call it the Jimmer effect and say that it came into play here, because both guys, you know, mentioned it in the interviews they did with me, at least, about, you know, being acquainted with BYU that way.
So one of the things you mentioned at the end of your article was you listed everybody who looks as of today to be on that roster for next year, excluding, of course, we'll exclude Chase Fisher because he does have to sit out because of the transfer rules. And, of course, anybody who is announced to be going on a mission or is already on one. But it's an interesting list, both from, especially on the guards wings, very deep, a lot of good players there. Let's start with those guards and wings. Obviously, Carlino and Hawes and Winder, they were there and contributed last year, and I think most fans feel comfortable knowing, even if the fans are a little split on Carlino, at least people feel comfortable knowing, having watched him play for a year and a half. Then we got Kyle Collinsworth coming back, who, if you followed the team a few years ago, obviously he was a major contributor. But then you've got Halford and Bartley as well. What do we expect out of Collinsworth coming back from his mission, and Halford and Bartley? Are they, of the three of them, just because Collinsworth was such an integral part a few years ago, do we expect him to get a lot of minutes? Do we expect Halford and Bartley to play a major role? And, yeah, I'll stop there before I load eight questions into one.
I'll address the three kind of separately, but I'll address an overarching philosophy that Dave Rose wanted to see implemented in this upcoming season that he was not able to implement in 2012-13. That was guard line versatility. There simply weren't enough guys able to do enough different things to allow Dave Rose to play the way he'd like to play, you know, to plainly state it. What you've got with the new guys coming in and the kinds of guys coming in are the ability to be a much more multifaceted guard line, to be able to play different kinds of lineups and get different kinds of results and play different kinds of defense. Last year, They were more or less locked into becoming a zone team where Dave Rose would like to be able to, especially on the perimeter, play more man. And what Collinsworth and Bartley in particular allow you to do is to be a better team defensively on the perimeter and have the ability to play more man and stay with more guys. So I think that before anything else, what Dave Rose wanted to fix was the guard and wing line and relative to their versatility. It wasn't there last year, and he's got more of it this year. Kyle Collinsworth will be anything from the 1 to the 4 this year, and we'll get to BYU's bigs in a second, but the way it looks right now, BYU is going to be thinner up front than they would like to be, and certainly thinner up front than they will be at the guard and wing lines. And so I think what you see in Kyle Collinsworth is somebody with the ability to be everything from a lead guard, bringing the ball up, to somebody that could play a small four for you. If you're going to play Josh Sharp as a four, as BYU did last year, you can certainly do the same with Kyle Collinsworth, beg your pardon. So I think everyone's excited about Kyle Collinsworth, again, as a guard, and as Dave Rose has talked about, a lead guard playing with Matt Carlino. But by the same token, he can also be used, it may have to be used, up front, depending on what BYU does, and we'll talk about the bigs in just a moment. So Kyle Collinsworth, while not a prototypical spot-up shooter, will be expected to do a lot for BYU. Uses athleticism both as a defender and as a versatile offensive player from the perimeter to the post should they choose to do so. Again, shooting's not his forte, but certainly getting to the rim and being a defensive inhibitor, I think, is right in his wheelhouse. And we'll see how well he recovers from mission legs and just how good he feels and how soon he feels ready to go. But he's certainly intriguing, if not somebody that can solve the three-point issue that BYU's had the last couple of years. But that's where Skylar Halford comes in. And I think Skylar Halford, if not a starter, will be the instant offense guy coming off the bench. And everything he shows, you don't become a first-team JUCO All-American without having some game to you. BYU's JUCO gets last year, Raul Delgado and Augie Ambrosino, did not have nearly the kind of resume that that Skylar Halford has. And it's funny because, Skylar was supposed to be a Utah State guy. And you would say, had Skylar Halford ended up there playing, you would say, wow, that's just another one of those guys that Stu Morrill gets. He gets them every year, those kind of guys that drive you nuts with their ability to be just tenacious offensive players working for their shot, making three-pointers. He gets them all the time, and he lost this one for whatever reason. I think BYU's fortunate to get Skylar Halford because everything about his game says instant offense, whether it's off the bench or as a starter. But he had a very impressive season at Slick, and again, first-team JUCO All-American is a significant honor based on who's out there on a year-to-year basis. So that's how I see Skylar. Frank Bartley, again, doesn't come into that shooting category where you're going to say he's going to fix the three-point problems, but that's Skylar Halford's deal. I think Skylar will help BYU, and certainly Chase Fisher, when he gets eligible, that'll be his objective as well. BYU should have better three-point numbers moving forward just based on those two guys being on the team alone. Frank Bartley, that's not going to be his forte from what I understand, but if you've seen Frank's film, he's just one of those athletic dudes that can kind of do a little bit of everything, and I think will be as important for BYU defensively as anything else. But only a freshman with a lot to learn in Dave Rose's system. Let's mitigate expectations a little bit. But again, gives you somebody that BYU didn't have last year in both Halford and Bartley, and we could add Kyle Collinsworth. You're bringing in three guys who have skill sets that BYU simply didn't have on the roster last year. So I think to that extent, they've already got a bit of a net gain from what they lost last year to what they're gaining. We haven't even talked about the bigs yet as we talk about Davies leaving and Worthington and Mika coming in. But I think even on the guard line, you can say BYU's already better now than they were maybe at the end of last season. Well, long answer for you.
No, that was I asked you like eight questions, so it requires a long answer, Greg. The bigs is where I think most people are look and go, well, yeah, Mika is coming in with a lot of hype, and Worthington as well, and of course Austin and Sharp and Ambrosino returning.
I'll interrupt for just one. The funny thing about Mika is, I think sometimes the word hype has a somewhat negative connotation to it.
Sure.
And in reality, the hype didn't develop for Eric Mika until you know, his season got going and he was already signed, sealed, and delivered for BYU. The great thing about Eric Mika is BYU had him so early, and he didn't begin to become a national name, you know, until his senior season. And that's when everyone began to kind of find out about Eric Mika. And by that time, he was already BYU's guy, which is a great thing for BYU because they didn't have to fight off the kinds of schools that would have been in the mix had Eric, say, had a junior season that he didn't have at Lone Peak because he was prevented from playing that year. So I think you know, the hype didn't come on till, or the publicity didn't come on till late for Eric Mika, but he's got the kind of talent that would have been promoted and hyped up a lot more had he been just eligible for that junior season. So I think Eric's a great get, and would have had, again, I think a ton more national renown had he been able to play that year before his senior season.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm excited. You watch that film of that team, and he definitely, I mean, they all kind of stand out. They were a fantastic team.
He's not going to be, I mean, Brandon Davies, you can't replace the Brandon Davies as a senior that we saw last year.
Right.
But he's going to be better than Brandon Davies was as a freshman. And you're, yeah, you know, I think Eric Mika as a freshman and Brandon Davies as a freshman, I think Mika has the edge there. So, you know, even if he gives them only what he's able to give them now, it's going to be just fine. I think if he were to give BYU 12-7 points and rebounds per game this year, they'd be ecstatic, you know. And whereas Brandon Davies, by the time he finished up, you know, where a big game for Brandon might be, you know, 32 points and 18 or 20 rebounds, a big game for Eric might be, you know, 22 points and 15 rebounds. You know, but so Brandon may be a bit more spectacular that way in terms of potential to have a big night, but Eric's going to be, I think, very reliable and I think a real pleasant surprise to a lot of people.
So on the returning side, Ambrosino, Sharp, and Austin, I think with Sharp, I think we know who he is, and he brings a lot of energy and got to play the four, probably not his natural position, but he gave it what he had, and I think that's to be commended. With Ambrosino, I don't feel like we really know.
Let's talk about Josh first.
Oh, I think, sure.
Yeah, the four is what he's going to have to be.
Right.
He doesn't shoot the ball well enough to be a three. If you're a three for Dave Rose, you've got to shoot it, and that's or you've got to have some special skill that allows you to play without that ability. And I think Josh is, you know, has to be a four. He's still a slight four. His objective is going to have to be get thicker and stronger as he goes along. But I really think that's his spot. And if he's just a depth four, then so be it. But I don't think, unless something happens, you know, in terms of what he's able to do in the offseason, I don't think he can slide to that three the way Dave Rose plays. That's just my guess right now. I think Josh is where he needs to be while he needs to get bigger and stronger. I mean, even as it is, he started, you know, 20-plus games this past year and actually did improve quite a bit from his freshman season to his sophomore season. You know, the injury at the end of the year takes him out, but I think that's kind of where Josh needs to be. Augie Ambrosino, we're not sure if he'll actually – if he's still going to be with the team this next season. There's enough out there that you know, involving Augie that may or may not come into play here in the short term that might affect whether or not he's part of this deal for the next season. So we'll kind of let that play itself out. Again, nothing's definitive right now, but I think there's enough uncertainty relative to his future that we have to kind of wait and see what the next few days or weeks bring relative, you know, to Augie. So we'll kind of let that one go for a bit. And with Nate Austin, you know, he's somebody that didn't have a healthy offseason last year. He had offseason surgery that you know, took him out for months, and he just had to play catch up for such a long time. By the end of the season, he was back to where you hoped he would be earlier in the year. But I think this year now gives Nate the chance to be healthy for an entire season, be in the gym exponentially more than he was last year, and hit the ground running at a much quicker pace than he did in 2012-13. And, you know, Nate's going to be pressed by Luke Worthington for time at the four, but Nate's got to be the guy, I think. I think Nate has to be that starting four for BYU with a good offseason behind him to help the Cougars reach their expectations that season.
Yeah, he's an interesting case, Greg, because you know, like you said, with the off-season surgery last year and not being able to hit the ground running, I think the other part for him is I think a fan expectation of what a big play's like may make some of us get a little too disappointed in what he actually can bring to the table. He is not going to ever be that back to the basket Brandon Davies post threat, I don't think. It hasn't shown that in the couple of years that he's been on the team. Is that fair to say that we really just have to adjust the expectations that the skills he brings to the table offensively, especially, are just different than maybe we've gotten used to the past couple of years with some of the bigs that we've had?
Well, I think we need to remember that, you know, Dave Rose has played forwards like Keena Young and Jonathan Tabernari.
Sure.
And so Nate Austin, JT, and Keena Young have three different, totally different games, and they were all starting four men for Dave Rose. So you know, Dave Rose isn't locked into any one particular guy playing at that spot, which I think those are three pretty instructive cases there between Keena Young and JT and Nate Austin. Those are the three most recent, if you will, kind of four men that have had, you know, the most time, and each three look very different in what they do. You know, Keena Young was strong as a bull, who could get his way to the rim, but also had a nice touch from the mid-range to the baseline. JT was someone who was a stretch four. He was a three-point specialist. And Nate Austin is somebody that, while taller than Keena Young or JT, doesn't, again, play with his back to the basket. He's a 6'11", 230-pound four-man that went to the jump hook, I think, two times last season.
Right.
By the way. And he scored on both those shots, by the way. But it's when he went to those shots, he went, oh, wow, here's a jump hook from Nate Austin to the middle of the floor, which looked really good for him, but was so foreign. He was a keep a ball alive kind of player. Does have a nice touch. I think he could develop a Noah Hart-Sakian type baseline touch and a baseline and short corner touch, and he can hit the three. Didn't have a great 3-point year last year, but that's also part of his game. Yes, I think he needs to be and will become more versatile as he goes along. He's only a junior coming up this season, but I think what Nate gives you are a lot of very desirable elements of someone's game. Of course, the last game he played, you know, against Baylor was his career high 11 rebounds, and he shot 70% plus in the NIT. I think that's who he can be. He's a really gifted shooter, a really soft touch for someone that size. You'd be hard pressed to find guys 6'11" that look as good shooting it when he does. Nice high shot. Doesn't look awkward at all. He's got a funky rotation. There's no doubt. The ball looks funny coming off his hands, but it's effective, and you can't argue with that. So I think what Nate will do is be balanced by Luke Worthington, who is now the kind of guy you're talking about being a banger for. Nate's not a banger for, but Luke Worthington is. And while Nate can really help you win games, Luke is the kind of guy that keeps you in games. And I think he'll be a great benefit to Dave Rose because he's a super physical, tenacious four that loves playing right around the rim. And so I think you've got a good balance between Nate and Luke. If those the two guys you had to rely on most at the four, with Kyle Collinsworth being kind of a wild card four, if you will, I think you'd be okay.
Yeah, I think it's going to be all right. The depth can be a problem if there are any injuries, which often there are.
Right now they have one open scholarship, and depending what happens with their other big, maybe two. Now it's great to have open scholarships, but it's nice if you have guys to fill them. And it's even nicer if you're able to commit them for more than a single year. But right now, BYU's in a scholarship crunch. I think I'd have to go back and check this, but I think right now they might only have room for one scholarship next season, where they have room for two right now. So they're really looking for at least one of the guys. It would be nice if they could find one of those 50-year senior graduates that has just one year left to play. They could really use that kind of guy this year. And then another guy who could take 2 years, of course. But that's where BYU is right now. We saw them last year have two scholarships go unoccupied, and it really hurt them. I mean, the Stephen Rogers, Chris Collins were scholarships were vacant. You get 13 and two were vacant. And it hurt BYU, absolutely hurt BYU. And they certainly didn't want to find themselves in the same situation again. But right now, there they are with one or two vacant scholarships again. They'd like to fill one, probably like to fill two if they can do it with the right kinds of guys, and ideally bigs. But we'll have to see what Dave comes up with here in the weeks to come.
Yeah, absolutely. It'll be interesting to see how he fills that out and maybe gets some additional depth up front. Yeah. Switching topics completely, Greg, to something you are also an expert in, which is Twitter. And we've got Bronco on Twitter now. Now it's a few weeks old, of course, so we're not breaking any news here on the podcast. But I was curious your take on Bronco on Twitter. You've been doing Twitter for a long time. You've been interacting with fans. And as a broadcaster, obviously that's a more natural part of your job than it is for some coaches who don't necessarily relish that type of thing. What's your take on him on Twitter? I know some fans doubt it's authentically him. I get every indication that it is authentically him, which is great. Is this just something that he has to do now in this modern age as a head football coach, or is this something you think they eventually the staff there wore him down to say to get him out there with everybody else?
Well, that was his joke initially, was that, you know, he finally wore down to the pressure, but that's really not who Bronco is either. It is Bronco, and it's more about him wanting to be the voice of the program, wanting to project and portray the messages that he wants portrayed in the way he wants them portrayed. I think his belief is that if he leaves it to other people to try and get the word out about what his program is, accomplishments, objectives, and just the integral elements of the program, it won't be done necessarily the way he'd like it. And I think he realizes that social media being so much the platform for those kinds of things, that he'd like to be in charge of what he can be in charge. And so for him, it was a decision that he came to a realization that it's prevalent enough and used enough by the people that matter to not only the program currently but in the future, that he'd like to be the guy, you know, kind of at the forefront, putting the word out to the best of his ability. And so that's really what it came down to. And I think, you know, to this point, you've kind of seen by what he's tweeting the kind of things he's talking about. I mean, he puts out there, you know, messages, facts, stats, things that represent you know, the best of his program. And he'd be in the distinct minority were he to stay off Twitter, because I think right now you're probably looking about 75 to 80% of FBS coaches have active Twitter accounts, and now he's one of them. And you know, half his staff is on Twitter. Dave Rose's staff less involved. He's got I think half of his staff on Twitter, but one that's really, I think Tim Lacombe's kind of the more out front coach from the basketball program on Twitter. Dave Rose isn't on yet, but you know, I think he feels his needs and Bronco's needs might now be a little bit different relative to social media, and that's just fine. But certainly they have representation on Twitter. The basketball program does. Football just seems to be a little more noticeable, and I think that's across the country.
Well, and is this, I mean, part of it's obviously recruiting. You know, that's something that I've noticed as you listen to the recruits talk. Like you said, I doubt it's a deciding factor, but certainly a lot of them follow some of their prospective coaches on Twitter and get a feel for that. And also it's a way they can get a little bit of feel for the personality of the player before they start recruiting. The other piece that for me coming out of the football program that I wanted to briefly chat with you about is, so now we're past spring practice. All that's wrapped up. Now it's kind of the quiet time besides Bronco being on Twitter, out there for the football team. We're not getting a lot of exposure to the players and certainly no other news is happening. That being said, there are some preseason previews going up, bit by bit. And as I peruse some of those, it looks like some of these folks are looking at BYU and saying, really good defense last year. Yeah, they lost a few players, but they still got Fanoy. So even if they're not as good next year, it should be a pretty good defense still. And, retooled offense? quarterback that played well in limited action last year as a freshman who was highly recruited out of high school. Maybe this is a sleeper top 25, top 20 team that could make some noise. Definitely not coming necessarily from a lot of BYU fans. I'm really referring to people that nationally maybe looking and kind of perusing the landscape. Do you think that's a fair assessment that some of these analysts are looking at? Do you think this really is a team that could have still a very good defense, but an offense that will be much improved and potentially a top 20 kind of team this season?
Well, I think that BYU with a decent offense last year would have been a double-digit win team.
Yeah.
And I think BYU's offense this year will be better than last year's and should be worth at least two wins somewhere along the line. I mean, you look at the games BYU lost here last year. Could they have found four more points at Utah? Could they have found one more point, two more points at Boise State? Could they have found four more points at Notre Dame? Could they have found a touchdown at San Jose State? You know, if the answer is yes to only half of those games, you're a 10-3 team. They were in far too many games to not win more than they did, and they didn't win because the offense performed at such a poor level.
Yeah.
And this year's offense will have to be better than last year's. I just can't see how they would take any steps back, even with a new offensive staff. There are just too many things going for it this year to not be better. And again, getting to 10 wins last year would not have been hard at all. And if it was a 10-3 or 11-2 BYU team last year, returning what they've got, they'd be in the top 25. And so I don't think BYU was too far away last year at all from having a really special season. But the dysfunction on offense revolving around that quarterback situation, which, I mean, that's almost worth a book. I mean, what happened last year at quarterback would make an interesting book. And in a lot of ways, thank goodness that, you know, part or that era is put to bed, because they can now focus just about going and doing things in a more conventional way. And I don't see how convention could do anything but hurt, but help this BYU team in 2013. So I expect, even though the schedule is as challenging as it's ever been, I expect this team to be good enough to be a double digit win team again.
Absolutely. Well, Greg, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. We'll, of course, continue following your off-season storylines at KSL.com. And, of course, look forward to listening to you on KSL come fall when the much-anticipated football season returns.
Well, I don't blog as frequently in the off-season, but I still keep tweeting a ton, and I've got a countdown going on Twitter right now. Every day until camp starts, I'm doing a fact of the day, and so every day something comes up that should get you excited about football season, a stat or a tidbit one way or the other, and so the countdown continues, and before you know it, Media Day will be here, June 26th, and then it's only another month or so until, they're actually on the field, getting ready to go again. It'll be interesting to see this year, what BYU does in terms of press access for camp. I'm not sure if we'll have exactly the same setup as last year or not. I've had kind of a routine covering camp for years now that's based on a few kind of daily habits that may or may not still in play this year. We'll see. But either way, it'll be a fun time to anticipate. And again, the season opener will be here before you know it, just 3 months and change.
You just got me all excited, Greg. So just talk about Media Day. It's like, wow, that's closer than I thought it was.
It is so coming.
It's coming right around the corner. Well, thanks, Greg, and we'll definitely have you on again before the season starts.
Always fun, Adam, and whenever you need me, just give me a call.
All right, Matt, this is the Rise and Shout podcast. We've been on a couple-week hiatus, but we have returned, and we've returned with renewed vigor and enthusiasm.
Back in action.
Back in action. Back in action. So now that you're out of school, have you just been, like, sitting around watching movies and stuff?
I've been to a few movies. Did I just say that weird word? That word weird? Did I say movies?
I don't know. You've been living in Indiana for 2 years, so.
I found a movie theater here in West Lafayette that's actually okay. And it's disappointing that I found it now. But I've watched a lot of baseball.
Nothing wrong with that.
I slept in a little bit.
Also nothing wrong with that.
But, you know, the past week has picked up a lot as we get ready to, you know, move out, so.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
So I have to actually get up in the morning and, like, get ready for the day, whatever that means.
Yeah, that's kind of lame. So have you seen Star Trek yet?
Yes, I did. I went, when did I see that?
I have not seen that. I'm going this weekend.
Oh, you haven't? Wait a minute. I saw the Star Trek movie before you did.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You out-geeked the geek.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm geek the geek.
Wow, this is what that feels like.
So I went to the Red Sox this weekend here in Minnesota instead of going.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, yeah. It's Target Field here in Minneapolis is gorgeous. And went on Saturday to see David Ortiz hit two home runs, which awesome. So I've also been watching a lot of baseball because I always watch a lot of baseball. That's just what I do during this time of year. So, Matt, let's switch to – we'll get back to movies in a second because we've got a fantastic tweetback question that we will address that is related to movies and specifically kind of related to one that came out earlier this year. But let's first talk BYU football. I recently tweeted out under our Twitter account for the Rise and Shout podcast a story written by Bill Connolly of SB Nation and Football Outsiders. Bill has also been a guest of this podcast a couple times, so we'll call him friend of the podcast, because why not?
Hey, aren't we all friends of the podcast?
No.
Can't we all just be friends?
We're going to get to Riley here in a minute. I don't know if he can be called a friend of the podcast anymore.
We're going to have to talk about that.
We'll get to his interview with KFan here in a minute. But let's start with this. Let's start with the good, man. So I'm going to sum up Bill Connolly's article, and then we'll go through some of the things that we noticed and observed as we read it. It's a very detailed preview, statistically speaking, but also he talks a lot about some of the individual players. But basically he sums it up by saying, pretty good defense last year. Won't maybe be as good, but still should be really good with Kyle Van Noy. And he, even in his headline, has KVN for Heisman in the headline. Offense should be a ton better. And, man, you look at last year, they lost two games they should have won, which, of course, we as BYU fans know that, Utah and Boise State. You look at that, they're really probably a better team than last year showed. So they could be a top 20 team and a sneaky top 20 team. Do you agree with Bill's assessment? And for full disclosure here, though we've had Bill on the podcast, he has no direct connection to BYU and is not a BYU fan. He's a Missouri football fan, and he doesn't really have any connection to BYU. So this is not somebody using stats to confirm his blue goggles looking at the 2013 season.
What I think is interesting about especially his use of the statistics here is it takes all emotion out of it.
Yes.
I mean, he is saying with some pretty, in my opinion, he's done some, you know, he's got some pretty in-depth statistical analysis here.
Yeah, Football Outsiders, who he also writes for, they do a fantastic job on all of this. Yeah, very detailed. Yeah.
And he's saying on paper, it'd be very easy for the 2012 season to have gone completely a different direction. And this team is in a position, given who's coming back and the positions and some statistical history, to do very well.
Yeah.
And it's as a BYU fan, I want to read this, and I'm like, oh, this guy's got his blue glasses on, because that's really what it sounds like. But to me, it's encouraging to hear this from somebody that isn't a BYU guy. But I was very skeptical of the things he was saying as I read through, even looking at some of the numbers and the way it's set up, because I'm a little more critical of some of the players individually outside of just a spreadsheet of numbers, because I've seen them, I watched them miss a block, or, you know, I watched them drop a pass or whatever. But I'll tell you what really got me believing was when I watched the Kyle Van Noy highlight reel that he included in that article.
Yes, yes.
Holy smokes. Van Noy makes me want to believe that Bill Connolly's on here and that this is a team that, if they can put it together on the offensive side of the ball, could sneak into the top 20. That Kyle Van Noy makes me want to believe.
Yeah, I think I totally agree with everything you just said. I think the big question marks, and Bill talks a little bit about this, but I'm going to actually add some analysis, Matt. Can you believe that?
Wow.
Add some analysis is you look at that schedule, okay, for 2013, okay, and he does a great job of breaking down the schedule by Football Outsiders' projected rankings. Okay, so he's basically saying, how tough is this schedule really going to be? And you look at that and you say, maybe the biggest impediment to them is they're going to have four teams that at least Football Outsiders at this point believes are top 15 teams on the schedule. That is maybe unheard of in BYU history. We've talked about how good this schedule will be. But after that, it's a bunch of pansies. Quite frankly, I mean, Georgia Tech at 38, but this is a top-heavy, bottom-heavy schedule. And if they could somehow pull off three of those four games, and I'm directly referencing Texas, Boise State, Wisconsin, and Notre Dame, two on the road, two at home, this could be one of the most special seasons, has that potential, if, once again, the offense can somehow be substantially better, not just marginally better, but a lot better than last year.
But, you know, coming to this schedule thing for a minute, yeah, it does feel like it's a really top-heavy schedule, right? And you look at, you know, and he makes comparison to, like, this is pretty much, you know, this is a BCS school type of schedule. So if you pull up Alabama's schedule for 2013, okay, just a quick rundown. They're going to play Virginia Tech, Texas A&M, Colorado State, Ole Miss, Georgia State, Kentucky, Arkansas, Tennessee, LSU, Mississippi State, Chattanooga, and Auburn.
Chattanooga, they're going to be tough this year.
Okay, this BYU schedule is as tough or tougher than what Alabama will face this year.
Yeah, and I think Bill's point about that, again, if he was not a kind of neutral observer, I think a lot of folks, especially those dressed in red, would read this is a BCS-like schedule and go, yeah, right. You know, they're playing Idaho State, for heaven's sakes. But the thing that makes it a BCS schedule, I kind of said pansies, but after that. But the thing that makes it is the fact that there is Georgia Tech, Utah State, Utah, if we want to call them a decent program, and Virginia. And, yeah, there's the Nevada's probably not going to be very good, and obviously Idaho State is not even in the same the same division. But there are some decent teams in the middle of it as well. Not teams we should beat, yes, but teams that, you know, if they were playing in the SEC, would be teams that would, you know, be in the middle to the middle third of that conference.
Yeah.
So, Matt, let's take a few other takes on some of the things that he mentioned. One of the things that he talked a lot about was that the offensive line did not help. And he cites some statistics on that, but also just said, you know, there was just not enough there as well. We all know that they got to get better. One thing he said that I thought was awesome was, as awesome as Hoffman's season was, it's even more impressive when you look at the other receiving options and how poorly, statistically, they played last season. That Hoffman actually, he says, and to quote him, it's a bit of a miracle that Hoffman was even able to average 8.6 yards per target, not per catch, per target, considering the attention defenses were able to give him. If they can take some of that pressure off of Matt, what do you expect out of Hoffman this year? I mean, it was despite those quote-unquote handicaps, he had 100 catches and 1,200 yards.
Yeah.
What could they do if Oppo can step up? Well, I mean, what is he capable of? Is this going to be potentially one of the best seasons for a wide receiver in BYU history, or am I pushing it even farther than Bill probably meant to?
I think that with good quarterback play and an offense that has some type of identity, I think Hoffman's ceiling is at least at the Austin Colley level.
Yeah, I totally agree.
You know, and I'm talking about Austin Colley as a college player, but I think he needs to have some things around him in order to create that type of situation where he can do it. And it's going to come down to quarterback play and whether or not we have any other receivers that are going to get open. But that number, what was it, 8.7 yards per target?
Yeah.
That's a good number even if you've got a good quarterback.
Yeah, yeah. But for a wide receiver that goes deep like him, it probably should be higher. But we had
a little trouble with the deep ball.
Yes, we did. As Bill points out, it is kind of a miracle that he had 8.6.
Mm-hmm.
When you did not have most of the passes thrown during the year were by quarterbacks who could not throw the deep ball. And by that, I'm referencing Lark and Nelson.
I'm not going to use names because I've moved on.
I have not.
But you know, so maybe I'm going too far by saying that number is good, even if you have a decent
quarterback. No,
I mean, maybe it isn't.
I don't think you're going too far. I think it is a good number. I just think a receiver of Hoffman's talent level and focus in the offense, I mean, they threw 32% of the passes went to Hoffman. Think about that for a second. A third.
Well, and if you're a defense, you know. I mean,
yes.
You know that's where the ball's coming.
And he still caught 100 balls and got 1,200 plus yards.
I'm just glad the ball made it 8.7 yards.
Well, sometimes remember that he's getting some yards after the catch.
Does this count as is he catching these on a bounce?
Oppo's like, I wish I could have. But
Oppo has been, I mean, he's been invisible. You know, quarterback play, offensive line play aside, I mean, where? Come on.
Well, and that's the thing. That's the thing.
I think everybody's still waiting for him to show up and flash some of what the program expected out of him early.
Well, and everyone keeps hanging their hat on a couple of decent games he had freshman year with Heaps as quarterback. That's a long time ago now. And I'm not trying to say he doesn't have the skills, but it's been covered quite extensively that he's not a great route runner and seems to kind of, I don't know if take plays off is the right thing because I'm not questioning his hustle, but maybe it's a mental focus issue. He caught 31 passes last year. Okay? Friel caught that many passes. Falslev caught more passes. Jamal Williams, who didn't break the starting lineup until 3-4 games into the season, had almost that many catches. Right? So you look at that and you say, wow, you know, if he could become a threat opposite Hoffman, if he could raise the level of his game, that offense could just take off, even if Hill's not as good as we hope him to be.
Well, and I think that's part of when you talk about what Hoffman's potential is. I think part of it is who else is going to be out there. I mean, Colley had Pitta. You got to have other people around you to free up some space.
Yes.
And you know, and I don't know who that guy is. Maybe it, I don't know who it'll be this fall. I'd love to see it be Oppo.
Yeah. Or maybe the tight ends. Maybe yeah, one of the tight ends. Maybe Friel or Mahina or Wilson really, I guess not Wilson, he left, huh? And Friel left too, didn't he? Maybe yeah, I'm just talking about Mahina.
I think our greatest chance here, I think the greatest chance is Oppo.
I agree with you.
I feel it was a long time ago, those couple of games, Adam, but I mean, he did look pretty good.
I totally agree. I'm certainly not disparaging those games. He was quite good.
Anyway, we'll see what happens. That was one of the things that I was surprised Bill didn't get to in his article was there wasn't a lot of talk about Anai's return. And, you know, what is the offense going to look like?
Probably he left that alone because there's not much.
There's not a lot of data.
Objective data to say because Anai was not the offensive coordinator at Arizona, right?
And he's not going to be doing the stuff that they were doing there.
Right, and he's not going to be running an offense, at least if you believe what they ran in the spring and everything that he's talked about with Pace. Nothing like the offense he ran when he was the coordinator. So, you know what I mean? Like, how do you analyze that? I mean, you can speculate, but Bill's article is very light on speculation, right? And very, very heavy on facts, which is great, which is excellent. So Matt, I feel good about his analysis, and like you, I read through it and I said, dang, this could be something. This season, you know, a lot of people I think are worried that this is just a year too early, but I'm not sure that's right, because a year from now, 2014, we will not have Kyle Van Noy, and we will not have Hoffman.
Oh, this is when it's got to happen.
This is the year, because we've got our two best offensive players returning and our best defensive player returning, and I think that'll be awesome. So,
well, and we've got a schedule here that would put us in a position to really make a statement.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And you're going undefeated. It's a BCS bowl, right? I mean.
Oh yeah.
So, absolutely. So. Going to that defensive side of the ball, our depth may take a hit, Matt. I'm going to shift away from Bill's article to a report a week ago about baseball standout Jacob Hanneman, who's technically on a football scholarship at BYU, not a baseball scholarship, but he's had a heck of a year in baseball, and it's possible he could be a high-round draft pick in the spring. The reports on that are fairly mixed. I follow baseball and the draft actually closely, and I think the local press is overstating his status as a prospect in baseball. That being said, he will get drafted. How high, we will see here not too far in the future. So Matt, what should he do? Say he's a third or fourth round prospect, which means, you know, he's going to be on a team and he's going to get a decent bonus, and they're going to want him to go play rookie ball shortly after the college season completes itself. What would you think he should do if you were talking to him, and what would you think he should do if you're thinking as a BYU football fan?
If I were talking to him just as a friend, he goes into those first, if he goes in those first couple rounds, he's going to get a good signing bonus. You go. You know, and baseball, you know, and if you compare, I don't know that we're going to be, say he doesn't go, I don't know that he strikes me as somebody that's going to have that kind of opportunity in the NFL. You know, maybe he is.
No, I don't
think. But right now, I don't see any indication of that. So.
Oh, he's a tremendous, by all accounts, he is an excellent athlete. So I probably shouldn't discount that, because he's got speed. I mean, that's
clear, right?
His speed and his quickness are one of the things that make him a standout baseball prospect. He is not, obviously, as a defensive back, goes probably without saying, but he's not some lumbering slugger up there. He's an athletic, five tool, as they say, type of baseball prospect. Maybe not way high up on the list, but certainly one that's climbed because of how he's performed in this baseball season.
I think you go. I think you have to take that shot.
And it'll depend on where he gets drafted, right? I mean, the farther he drops, the less attractive it becomes.
Yeah, and you can always wait and do it again next year and see if you can improve your stock some.
Yeah.
You know, but then you run the risk of, you know, what if he gets hurt playing football? I mean, which of these two sports present him with the greatest opportunity?
Well, and baseball's the quote unquote, especially if you're a hitter and not a pitcher, the safer sport. You know, less likely to have a career ending injury. And certainly the effect long term it may have on your body will probably be better than playing football. And like you said, I don't know that at this point he would be considered an NFL prospect. Doesn't mean he couldn't become one. But unfortunately, it puts Bronco Mendenhall in a difficult situation on the defensive side of the ball. If Hanneman does not come, we're lacking depth at the defensive backfield. Last year, that group played very well. But unfortunately, we lost a lot of that depth. So what's the, how key is it if he doesn't show up? Are we in trouble? Did some of what we just talked about and being all excited kind of get shot up if he doesn't end up coming back to the program?
I don't think it destroys it, but I think it definitely adds question marks to the defensive secondary. I mean, you know, you're looking at it's a unit that consistently, you know, raises questions at this time of year. You know, and this is a guy that was going to be competing for a starting spot. So I think that definitely raises some questions, you know, because you have to be able to, you know, for the defense to do the kinds of things they did last year, to open stuff up for Van Noy, you've got to have decent play in the secondary, and you've got to have some type of combination in those front seven to open him up to make plays. And maybe this kid is the piece. You know, and if he is, you know, which we don't really know, but, you know, in the world of hypotheticals, if he is the piece, it could kill it. Right now, I don't feel like it does, but it definitely raises the risk level that maybe that's not the term I'm looking for, but it definitely makes the secondary look a little less attractive.
Yeah, and I mean, depending on, you know, what you believe, the excellent BYUroster.com site has him listed as a backup anyway, right? I mean, he's really depth, and that's the unfortunate thing, is they just don't have a lot of depth, right? And maybe he would have earned a starting job in fall camp. We'll see, but it's definitely could make it more difficult. So, Matt, another note on football. KFan recently did an interview with Riley Nelson. We'll link to it in the notes to this podcast. Mr. Riley Nelson was on. His plans are to go to medical school.
Not a surprise.
Where does he plan to go again?
I can't even talk about this.
Some school that has a medical program in Utah.
Oh, my gosh.
I think there's only one of them. But anyway, and he's going to be an assistant coach at Logan High School in the fall as well, because he won't go to medical school until a year from the fall.
Yeah, apparently the application process is very, very long.
Especially when you start it after the football season's done.
Well, I think you have to, right?
Yes, absolutely. That's not a criticism. That's just saying. I mean, the reality is, you know, he was a quarterback, had a lot going on.
He had a lot going on.
So, a couple of things.
Of course, he could have been filling it out. He was already at the hospital. I don't know where you submit your medical school application, but he was talking to doctors enough.
Well, he had some time on the bench at the end of the year, too. Yeah. So Matt, we won't belabor his interview, but let's quickly say what was the number one thing out of that interview that you took away.
I think what's interesting is, and we've talked about this before, the decision whether or not to play him when he was hurt. And, you know, what it sounds like to me, you know, obviously the coaches knew when he had, you know, fractured vertebrae. And, you know, his own evaluation of the level of pain he was in aside, you know, the coaches are in a position, no player, I feel like I can't fault him for wanting to play when he was hurt and for trying to compete when he was hurt. And it sounds to, at least the way he tells the story is, the coaches looked at the way he was playing in practice, evaluated it, and decided that he was at a level where he presented them with an opportunity to win those games. And, you know, in retrospect, he was not in any position to do that. You know, he talks about, you know, at the Utah game, he says the pain was so bad he was having a hard time keeping his hands from shaking. You know, if you're in that kind of pain, like, you are not in a position to lead a team over the hump to win a close football game like that. It's just not going to happen.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and I've been very critical of Riley Nelson. I won't shy away from that. And
no,
one thing I did love about this thing, maybe the second piece was, is he owned the poor performance.
He did.
You know,
he
said
did.
Something like, I can't make any excuses. You know, I can't say that, you know, bad pain, that excuses four turnovers against Utah. I mean, the fact that he's willing to take responsibility for that, even when he was playing that type of energy, there is some admirable piece to that. But I feel like this is a coaching failure.
Yes, I think
he should not have been on the field.
Yeah, and we talked about that quite a bit, you know, during the season, that we, you know, it's not the player's job you know, the coaching staff and the training staff really should be the ones, you know, determining that. What I will push back on a little bit is I think there is a mentality, and it's very common in football, to play hurt, right? That because almost every football player by some point in the season, if not the very first game, everybody's feeling some pain of some kind, you know. Offensive linemen play, you know, if you read interviews with some of them post-career, they play their entire careers in different levels of pain, you know. But the one thing I push back on is it should have been clear to him, and he even mentioned this in the interview, that he knew he couldn't, he didn't have the thrust, he didn't use that word, but his ability to take off and run like he usually would. Some of those other skills were lacking, and he admitted he knew that those skills were lacking. At some point, though, that tough guy routine, which I admire him for playing hurt. I'm not disparaging him for that. I actually like Riley, and listening to him didn't make me think, wow, what a loser, right? I thought, oh, you know, he owned, like you said, he owned it. On the other hand, at some point, don't you have to step aside? Is that too much to ask of a 23-year-old dude to say, you know what, and when it does happen, and I'm looking at you, Jay Cutler, and you do take yourself out of the game, people then just hammer you, right?
Yeah.
As a wuss.
But, that's right. It's a two-sided thing.
But he says he doesn't listen to the press, and I'll take his word for that, that he didn't hear all of this going around. So assuming he doesn't care what people outside of the program think of him, wasn't it kind of selfish in the end? Isn't that actually a selfish attitude as opposed to stepping aside and saying, you know what, me at 60% or Taysom Hill at 100%, Taysom Hill is the better bet for us to win football games?
I'm going to disagree with you. And I think I would have
felt differently. That's not allowed on this podcast.
I think I would have felt differently about this before I listened to the interview. But I think it is too much to ask of a 23-year-old kid who has dreamed his entire life of playing on that level, knowing that he's not going to make it to the NFL.
Right.
And he is now a senior at the school he's wanted to play football for at the marquee position his entire life. He's going to play if the coaches are going to let him play. And had the coaches sat him, had the coaches made the decision to sit him, which is probably what they should have done, I think he would have accepted that. But as long as he was going to compete for that slot as much as he could.
He did accept it at the end of the year,
mm-hmm.
right? He thought he was healthy enough to come back. Coaches did not. I never saw him act out on the, you know, he looked.
No, he got it when he totally understood it when they pulled him out.
And in this interview with K-Fan, he was extremely respectful of that decision. He probably didn't feel as respectful in the moment as none of us would, because you want to be out there playing. But he has, in public at least, to my knowledge, always been respectful of their decision to start Lark at the end of the year, including in the bowl game. And I think, my criticism of Riley Nelson has always been as someone playing the quarterback position, not as a teammate or as a person. You know, as a person, I have not enough data and would never try to do that on this podcast. That's our new podcast called Us Criticizing People Podcast. It's going to be a hit.
It's going to be awesome. People love that stuff.
People love that stuff. It's always been about, I just didn't think he was, you know, a good enough quarterback to really help us win a lot of football games. Not that he wasn't trying hard enough.
Is where he came up short was, you know, basically, I mean, he was broken. His body was broken. And that is a much more visible type of weakness than being overconfident in your accuracy, because it affected everything that he did. Everything about his game changed. He couldn't run anymore. You can't throw because, you can barely twist your trunk. I mean, how are you supposed to throw a football 50 yards downfield?
You just said twist your trunk. All right. So, Matt, we have a couple of tweet bag questions, and we are – well, I mean, this is going to be a long, long podcast, folks. So one quick one. Can BYU bring back the Biv Uni for a throwback game in 2013? That's from Zach Bloxham. That's at Z Bloxham on Twitter. The answer is an emphatic no for me, Matt.
I think Zach is trolling us.
I think he may be.
I will, if they do, I will not watch that game out of protest.
No, you won't. You'll watch the game.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, you're a liar. So,
the unis are atrocious, though.
They were atrocious.
But if they bring them back, I'm going to have to buy one because I'm going to need a bib to catch the throw up that I'm going to expel when I look at that jersey.
Nice. I see what you did there.
Did I just say expel? I wasn't sure what verb to use. I got a little lost.
I don't know. We're like 30 some odd minutes into this podcast. Our portion of the podcast. So, you know.
Nobody's listening anymore.
No, nobody's listening. So Matt, speaking of nobody listening, we are going to do a quick draft. This is also from a tweet bag question. This is from Jed Higginson on Twitter. Let's hear your snake draft of Marvel superhero movies. Here's the rules. You will get first pick, Matt. These are any movies based on Marvel comic book characters since the year 1998. So that starts with the movie Blade, which, of course, neither of us has seen because it's an R-rated
film. I've never even heard of it.
So that won't be on our list, but that's just where the timeline starts, if you will. So it can be both ones that Marvel now makes as Marvel Studios or ones that are made by other studios but based on Marvel comic book characters. So snake draft, we're going to do three each. What do you got first?
See, this is tough for me because my first pick, I want to go with my favorite.
Yeah, but I don't have
a lot of fear that you're going to be chomping to take this movie off the board.
So, take the best player on the board, man. What kind of draft philosophy is that?
Well, I go with the draft philosophy of, you know, what does my team need? You know, what do I want? That's what I'm going to do here.
All right. So
I'm going to draft the 2009 X-Men Origins Wolverine.
No, there was zero chance of me taking that.
I know. But it is, in my opinion, that's my favorite one. I've always loved Wolverine as a character, and I loved that movie before I even saw it. They had me at the trailer.
I liked that movie. The end kind of fell apart for me.
When I saw that movie, I was in a movie theater, and towards the end, fire alarm went off. They evacuated the entire theater. We're all out in the parking lot for about 45 minutes, and then we come back in. And I knew we were close to the end. We come back in, sit down, they restart it, and there were about 25 seconds left in the movie.
Oh, my gosh.
It really sucked the suspense out of that. I think it was less than 25 seconds. It was probably 15. It was one shot, really. Anyway, so I had to go back and see it again. They gave me a free ticket. I came back the next night.
Yeah, there you go. It all worked out. All right, my first pick is easy, The Avengers from last year.
See, I saw that coming.
That's easy. You know, I thought of using the first pick on Elektra. Just kidding. But yes, The Avengers was awesome. And as someone who grew up reading that comic book as my favorite, it was kind of a fulfillment of a geeky boyhood dream. So to see those characters up on film together. So Matt, I get the next pick because this is a snake draft.
This is tough because I think you might take my second pick.
No, I don't think I'm going to. I think you're going to get it because I'm just going off of the ones on my list. I'm going off on my board. Take the best one available. Right. And I'm going to take X-Men from 2000.
Oh, wow.
And the reason I'm going to pick that one is it's not as good a movie as some of the subsequent ones have been. But to me, that's the one that kicked off this awesome era of comic book movies. When Bryan Singer took the X-Men characters, yeah, he did some things with them, some of which I didn't necessarily like, but he had some good casting, especially Hugh Jackman as Wolverine, though physically doesn't look like the character from the comic books, was able to capture a lot of the essence that I liked about Wolverine, and you already picked, of course, another movie where he's in it as Wolverine. But to me, that kicked off this awesome era of comic book movies, so I'm pretty stoked about that. So I take the X-Men with my second pick. Matt, with your second pick.
I'm surprised that you give that 2000 X-Men the credit for kicking off this era of comic book movies. I would have given it to 1986's Howard the Duck.
Yes, a very, very underlooked picture. It was, of course, Howard the Duck. Wasn't it, I believe it was directed by Ron Howard. Is that true? No, Bill Willard Huck. It was, why did I think it was directed by Ron Howard? But it does star Leah Thompson and Tim Robbins.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean.
Unfortunately, it's not eligible for our draft because of the year it came out in.
That is true. All right, so your second pick.
With my second pick, I am taking Iron Man 1 from 2008.
Nice.
That whole series, I love it. I love the way that character's been developed. I think that,
you stole my next one. So
I think Robert, I thought that I might. I thought that you might take it number two, actually.
It was close. It was close. It was very
and
close.
I think Robert Downey Jr. does a really good job the way, what he's done with that character.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't know that anybody else could have done it quite the same way. So the casting there is brilliant. And it is, I love the way the story evolves and sets up for other things. It's just a fun movie.
Absolutely. All right. So
that's my number
two. Final.
My third and final pick. This is where things get a little bit dicier for me. I'm going to go with, you're going to give me a second. I'm waiting to see if a trade offer comes in for this pick.
There will be no trade offer, I don't think.
No, it's not going to be a trade offer. I'm going to go with
well, this is an intriguing.
All right, I'm going to do the first Spider-Man.
Oh, nice pick.
Okay,
nice
so
pick.
I bounced back and forth between one and two here. But I like what they. I like one. I'm going to go with one. Spider-Man 2002.
Nice.
Nominated for two Oscars, I might add. So I'm not alone in my assessment of this film.
What Oscars were those? That'd be like makeup and special effects,
it's
right?
Got to be special effects or something. So, I'm sure that it's in here somewhere.
Yeah. So that's your final pick, right?
I believe that is my last pick.
So my final pick is, I this was really tough for me, but I'll go with my pick and then I'll say the movies that I didn't pick. I was actually going to do Spider-Man. So you got me twice. I'm actually going to go with Iron Man 3.
Yeah, you know what? That had some consideration.
It's recent, but man, I really love that movie. And I realize I picked two of my movies in the last 2 years, and they did do some excellent movies besides that. I also considered Ghost Rider. I'm totally kidding. I can't even get that out with a straight face. I didn't consider Ghost Rider. Anything with what's his bucket is terrible. That's
Nicholas
not true.
Cage.
No, that's
he
not
was
true.
Good in National Treasure.
Yeah, and what's the one with Sean Connery breaking out of the
Rock?
The Rock, yes. I haven't seen that one, but if I had, excellent action film.
Yeah, I heard it was pretty good.
Yeah, I heard it was pretty good. So anyway, I like Iron Man 3 a ton. I also considered with this pick looking at X-Men First Class, which I think is very underrated. It did good in the theater, but not, you know, gangbusters, and I really actually like that retelling of the X-Men. But picking two out of three as X-Men flicks seems a little over the top, if I do say so myself. And I also thought about The Amazing Spider-Man, the new Spider-Man one.
I never saw that.
You should. You should.
I didn't see it.
It doesn't have the novelty of the 2002 where, wow, we get to see Spider-Man up on the screen for the first time. But I do think it's a better film. Like, I think it holds together a little better in some ways. But on the other hand, the story was not maybe as tight as the 2002. But one of the problems I have with the first series of Spider-Man movies is I can't stand Kirsten Dunst. She bothers me. So every time she's on screen, I'm like, ugh. Ugh. You know, so... Emma Stone is much, I think, much better. Granted, different character, but much better at the acting thing, you know, which is kind of important. And of course, I also like Captain America, which I could go on, but I'm gonna stop. So this I got my geek on right here. But
yeah,
you outgeeked me on this.
Oh,
podcast.
we got a little geeky here.
Yeah, you outgeeked me on this podcast because
which does not happen often.
You have seen Star Trek. Into Darkness, and I have not, though I will remedy that by the time we record another podcast. As far as the future of the podcast goes, probably 2 weeks or so before our next one, give or take. I'm hoping to get Bill Connolly to come on and talk about his preview. We've been unable to get our schedules to coincide yet, but hopefully be able to do that. You've got to move and stuff. And
relocating the home office.
Relocating the home office. But this has been an extremely long podcast. If anyone is still listening, you can tweet at me. Tweet at us what your top three Marvel movies would be. How's that? For anybody that's still listening. So there won't be any tweets where I'm at.
No.
No, there won't be any tweets. But if you are.
I'm not even going to tweet it, Adam.
No, you're not going to listen to this podcast. You should listen to Greg, though, because he was excellent talking about the basketball roster and what we're thinking about for next season and what he thinks, who will play and all that stuff. So you should.
Oh, yeah, I'll pick up the Greg. I mean, as much as I love to, you know, I don't listen to myself every time.
I don't listen to you every time.
That's right. I don't even listen to you half the time while we're recording.
Well, thanks, everybody. We enjoyed this. It was fun, as always. We'll be back in a few weeks. Thanks for downloading. Thanks for listening. And, of course, we'll catch you next time.
And go Cougars.
Say that again?
Go Cougars.
Oh, that worked better that time.